Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today, on Friday, July 2nd, 2010, God, I can hardly believe it's July, I am delighted to welcome Marissa Louie, who is the CEO of HeroX, or HeroX. Welcome, Marissa.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you. It's great to be back on here. It's my third time on here again.
And we're glad to have you. And we'll reference that a little bit for people that missed Monday's show. But let's start by zeroing in on your company and just explaining what it is for listeners who may not already know.
So HeroX, I started it about 11 months ago because I was thinking about the history of the Roman Empire and the city of Rome, which I actually coincidentally visited about 2 months ago. The city of Rome lied at the center of the Roman Empire, and if you remember the phrase, all roads lead to Rome, Rome was at the center of this sort of network that looked like a spider web. And so back over 1,000 years ago, the liveries, which were made by messengers, Hermes was the messenger of, or was the god of messengers, either Hermes or Mercury, depending on whether you're looking at Greek or Roman history. But Nuntius were sort of the royal army messengers for the king or the emperor. And Nuntius were the equivalent of what we have today, which are runners and couriers, messengers. And back then, they would have deliveries made so much more quickly by foot throughout the Roman Empire than we have today, where we order things online. We pay, on average, about $5 in shipping to buy something on Amazon.com. We wait, whether it's 3 to 5 days or 5 to 8 days, we wait for several days to get shipping, even though it's usually something that we want right away. So I thought, over 1,000 years ago, it was much more efficient, but now, in 2010, it's completely backwards. We have to wait for several days because of the huge sort of red tape that we have in scaling this whole delivery system. And so I said, well, why don't we provide an option where we can deliver things, where you can buy things from our website and get them delivered in under 1 hour and not charge too much more than $5. We charge $9. And so it all sort of spun out of me thinking about the Roman Empire.
Very cool. I mean, it's a great story. And I'm wondering, if there were actual, besides looking at the market and seeing opportunity very entrepreneurially, if there were other factors that came into the idea specifically for San Francisco of this idea right now.
Yeah, definitely. San Francisco, it's pretty much 7 miles by 7 miles or slightly smaller than that. It's a perfect test market. My family has actually been in San Francisco for almost 100 years, and so I know the lay of the land really well, and I know that this market is perfect for it because it's really densely packed. Population is pretty densely packed into certain corridors of the city even. And we live in this hustle and bustle society where we want things, we need things, and we often can't get them unless we have someone to help us or unless we take time out of our own precious schedule.
Yeah, which is, absolutely key. Tell us a little bit more about the specifics of the service, because I think there's what kinds of products you offer and how, because I know there's a weight factor as well.
Yes. Yes. So the products we offer, we are gearing HeroX towards selling more so higher-end consumer electronics items like iPhones and iPads, Blackberries, universal cell phone chargers, USB sticks, things like that that you might need on the road or in a pinch, and also high-end luxury goods that are sort of staples that are timeless, such as Burberry scarves, Chanel No. 5 perfume, things like that, where travelers and busy business people need these items. They can't wait for them, and they especially can't wait for them in an emergency or in a time crunch.
So
how it works is a consumer either goes to our website or they use our desktop icon, which is available for download on our website, or they go through our hotel or business partners who are offering the HeroX service, and they order by buying something through our website, and the items that we directly offer are all under 25 pounds. And if things are over 25 pounds, we tend to sort of have a hesitation about delivering them. But right now what we're offering is we will deliver anything under 25 pounds in 1 hour or less within the city bounds of San Francisco.
Very cool concept, because it's like having that, I can imagine, you know, flying, anytime you need to fly somewhere or travel, especially, mm-hmm. you realize you don't have that one thing that you absolutely have to have. Or that makes your life a lot easier. And it seems very smart to, you know, target in that way, you know, sort of the high-end market for that, which we know San Francisco, you know, one place home prices don't decrease, or at least not by much, is San Francisco, et cetera. But
right.
I have to ask you, you know, there's, you know, I always solicit questions in, and anyone's welcome to send questions this way. Go over to jenniferlindsay.com and find out how. But one of the things, of course, people remember from the first dot boom was Cosmo.
Yes.
And then the other was Webvan, which Cosmo mm-hmm. was more like, I remember working at a startup and we wanted ice cream and DVDs. So Cosmo would deliver those. And then Webvan was a grocery delivery service. So obviously very different services.
Yes.
But I'm wondering
yes.
if their stories impacted or had any impact, and if so, how, to your business model?
Yes. Well, the problem with Webvan was it was groceries, which you can't get a revenue margin on. Even if you sell 1,000 bananas, what are you going to really earn on selling 1,000 bananas across maybe 500 orders? You're not going to really gain much in revenue in exchange for the processing, in exchange for the personnel effort, and also they had the refrigerated trucks. If you remember, they had a fleet that they tried to disperse across the United States. And so it was a high overhead in exchange for a low margin, and it just really didn't make sense. It required a lot of marketing. And I mean, it was a great service for people who used it, but I just remember thinking about the environmental impacts of having a huge truck just deliver me maybe two bananas. The same thing with Cosmo, actually, K-O-Z-M-O, if anybody remembers that. It was about 10 years ago, from 1999 to 2001, it was in existence. Cosmo, it started out as a great idea. It was a great idea for consumers because you can sign up. You were able to sign up for Cosmo and get a free delivery for your first order if you provided a new email address. The problem there was people would just provide different new email addresses and always get free deliveries on things like gum and ice cream and bananas and things like that. So they came across a very similar problem in that they were also selling a lot of sort of lower end items. Now, when it comes to HeroX, jump about 10 years later, we've learned some lessons from the mistakes that they've unfortunately had, but I mean, I do appreciate that they sort of helped pave the road here. With HeroX, I mean, we charge $9 for standard delivery orders. If we are selling something on our website directly, for example, an iPod or an iPad, which you can buy from our website directly. If it's one of those items that we're listing, it costs $9. And if it's a custom order for something that you want, for example, people have requested certain books that are only available at certain bookstores, certain food items, certain things like that, the orders are $20 for custom orders. And so you're still saving, I mean, a huge amount from overnight deliveries from FedEx and UPS, which are, for a 20-pound order for overnights from FedEx and UPS, it's about $80.
Yeah, I mean, it's
And so we cut the cost from $80 down to either, you know, $9 or $20 for a one-hour delivery.
So, you know, the geek in me goes, you know, iPhone 4 just came out. You know, how do you handle that? I mean, do you pre-order a certain amount so that if you have you know, customers that are going to, you know, are going to want it, you know, maybe pre-order them? And how do you gauge the demand? Because you're still in alpha, right?
Yes, we're still in alpha. We are about to transition to beta, probably in about a month or two. But what we do have is a business account with Apple. So we have a special account where we don't have to wait in the long lines. And so we have a sort of a fast pass towards just picking up items from Apple and then delivering them. So we've got a special relationship with Apple.
Well, that's a nice thing to have.
Exactly.
Everybody's going to be online now trying to figure out how you get that kind of relationship, which I guess brings me to another question that, you know, I was quoted by Phil Bronstein, surprisingly enough, from the Chronicle and Huffington Post yesterday about Social Media Day. So I know that there are a lot of naysayers in the social media space, and online. Partially, I think folks can justify it because there's been two dot booms, dot busts. But do you feel that there are competitors out there or specific people who have maybe done this before that want you to fail? And if so, how do you deal with that?
How do I deal with that? Well, I mean, there aren't really real-time sort of one-hour delivery services that are doing it in the way that we are. There are courier services which essentially allow you to sort of say, I need these legal documents delivered to this place. I need these sort of things to be transferred from one place to the other. There's no way to sort of buy an item that you want and also have it delivered. There are also real-time services providers, startups like Red Beacon, for example, allow you to say, oh, I need my dog walked, I need my pet to be babysat, I need certain things to be taken to the dry cleaner. There's that sort of stuff out there, but there's nothing really in direct competition for what we're doing right now. There are sort of slower models where things can be delivered in a longer period of time, but there's nothing really where you can buy something and get it delivered in 1 hour.
That makes it kind of a cool thing. You know, you feel like you've got the right concept at the right time. But, you know, staying just on this track for just one more question, you know, any big issues that you've really come up against from conception to execution?
Big issues is just, we were never really in a stealth mode. We fleshed out our website and our Facebook app within the first month after I came up with the idea. And so we haven't had any issues on that sort of the keeping the idea secret or anything. We want people to know about it. The bigger issue is just scaling. As we grow outside of San Francisco is our first market because it's a smaller and denser market, and so we are perfecting our logistics and working with our local couriers and whatnot here before we expand elsewhere. So the real test will be in larger cities like New York City. We're thinking about Las Vegas. We're thinking about Los Angeles. And we're thinking about international cities, possibly Dubai, possibly Tokyo, possibly Hong Kong, possibly London and Paris. And so the real test comes when we go to slightly larger cities where we need to develop our local context there and our local courier partners. And so that's the bigger issue, is scaling it and just making sure that we are continuing to grow the business.
So in terms of scaling and even coming up with the concept, how are you, basically doing the market research and getting all of the facts that you need as an entrepreneur to move forward? Is it a team? I would imagine that a lot of this is just you actually going out there and finding out this information. But I think that would be an interesting question, sort of speaking to other would-be entrepreneurs out in our listening audience.
Sure, yes. Well, we do have a CMO and a CTO and my assistant and other sort of contractors who are working with us as well, and also our PR our PR firm. And so we're working with several people here on the team, and we've got a really solid team. Our CMO, Roger Phillip, he had a background in where he helped sell two companies. One he sold, he helped sell from growing it from a startup of about two people to over a few thousand, sold that company to DHL, who is also, you know, in the delivery space, and also helped sell another company and grow it from pretty much zero to a few hundred people, sold that to IBM for $2.1 billion. So he's really familiar with this space as well. And so we've done a lot of market research into other cities, into looking at which niches need certain things, into looking what sort of types of personalities or sort of user profiles want certain things. And so we're definitely having a very honed marketing strategy as we continue to expand.
And it's super clever to have someone like that from DHL. I know, having been a Peace Corps volunteer, DHL delivered to Turkmenistan in the late 90s, early 2000s, and that was a big deal because they were almost the only service where you were pretty much guaranteed that somebody wouldn't rifle through your delivery and steal things.
Yeah, exactly. And DHL, I think it's the best option. It's just unfortunate that we don't have it here. But they're really good at doing overnight deliveries and things like that. They're sort of on a tighter time schedule than in general UPS and FedEx are.
Yeah, they're
that's definitely why we have them on board.
Yeah, that's so smart. So smart. So, you know, in assembling this team, because it sounds like it's, you know, you've got some brilliant minds, and you have, you know, past successes that I'm sure play into this. But, you know, how do you select the right team?
Yeah, I mean, it just a lot of it comes through experience. And so this is my third startup. Heroic is my third startup. And my previous startup, AdVillage, I mean, we had up to 20 people. And then before that, we had a startup of about three people. And so I've just sort of come to experience working firsthand with people in the startup environment and just learning what I need to have on my team, what skill sets I need to have on my team early on, and then also just as we grow, what additional needs we have. And so I've been able to learn and to grow along the way myself and to understand this as more of a science.
And, you know, so, I mean, for people that don't have that experience, I mean, what would you say to them, you know, in terms of the research and knowing when to hire? I mean, I get these questions all of the time from smaller startup businesses, but obviously, you know, having had businesses under your belt, you know, if you don't have the experience, what do you suggest to people? What should they be reading or tuned into?
Yeah, definitely. Well, there are several resources. There's venturehacks.com, VENTUREHACKS.com. It's done by my friend Naval Ravikant and also Babak Nivi, and they have started WebMD, or actually Naval has started WebMD before successfully sold that for a huge amount of money, and now he's in angel investing in startups, and he's providing a lot of tips. Everything from funding sheets to how to evaluate your co-founders, how to divvy up the founder's pie, lots of really good startup culture types of blog posts there that are really helpful. Also, Y Combinator by Paul Graham. That has a lot of articles and resources that are similar to what VentureHacks has, and they have quite a lot of interesting things that go in depth in terms of the details of how to evaluate financing, how to assess at what point to get more funding for your startup. But what I would say is to make sure it really depends on your starting situation as an entrepreneur. Do you have funding personally? Do you have friends who are willing to invest in you as a person rather than as to invest in the startup as an idea? Do you have a past track record of being an entrepreneur and are thus able to raise money slightly more easily than somebody who is unproven and untested. There's also the question of, well, or do I have friends who are willing to start this with me for sweat equity, and they don't need compensation for now until a certain point when we raise more funding. So it really depends on how you start out in terms of coming up with the idea and then fleshing it out. And so what I would say is typically it's a new founder who hasn't been tested. Let's take that as a scenario. And they have a friend that they've come up with an idea together with, and they worked on. So maybe it's two or three co-founders. And what I would suggest is that they make sure that they try to test out the prototype of the website really quickly and see if there is actually a market and a demand for what they're working on. And then if there is, then work on certain proof points to say, hey, we reached 200 customers within our first 2 weeks. Hey, we're going to take that to whatever angel investor and see if that's interesting to him and try to pitch him and see if we can raise more funding. So what I would say is iterate really quickly and figure out whether or not it's a fail. And if it's a fail, it's quite all right. I've had startups that, you know, I mean, in the past where, you know, AdVillage, we're about to sell it, but my startup previous to that, it didn't go anywhere, and we were working on it for maybe 6 months, but we decided to sort of throw the towel in because it wasn't worth pursuing the opportunity and it wasn't the right timing. So just because a certain startup idea doesn't take off doesn't mean that you shouldn't try. It doesn't mean that you should worry about whether or not your first venture has legs or not. It's all about just trying and learning and sort of adapting along the way. And very often a lot of startup founders don't hit it big with their first try.
Really, really very smart analysis there. I mean, I think that's, you know, such good advice and some places to go. I'm linking to the sites that you're mentioning as we go here, so
okay,
you can
great.
Find them on our blog post. And you know, please use the resources because Marissa is a great resource that way. And so I think that is a really good segue into a little bit more about you. You're obviously very social media savvy. You're also very press savvy. You've had an unbelievable amount of press. So tell us what the secret is to your success besides being a good businesswoman and having a really clever idea.
Well, thank you. It comes with a past string of things that I've run and just experience in running those things. But it's not just I don't claim to be a social media expert, although we are, Jennifer, you and I are going to be at the Social Media Marketing Conference 2010, July 8th, San Francisco, which I'm sure we'll get to later on in the program. But yes, although I am co-coordinating that event, I don't claim to be a social media expert. I claim to be a student of social media. I claim to be just learning and investing in it and trying things out. While I think social media is great, I think it's not the ultimate key to success here. And so that's why, you know, I'm not completely, I think, focused in just social media. But as you mentioned, there are other areas of focus, such as being in the press. And so with the press, my strategy there has always been in developing and investing in relationships with reporters and with different people from different news agencies. And so so I have friends at pretty much the majority of the press outlets that could possibly write about me, just because I've developed these relationships and friendships over the past 3 or 4 years. And it doesn't come overnight, but it just comes with valuing the person behind the pen or behind the radio talk show or behind the newspaper column, et cetera. And, you know, I've developed those trusted friendships because I actually do really value them as a friend. We hang out. I hang out with a lot of friends who are also members of the press, who are official members of the press. Also, another thing that I've done is I've guest blogged at a few places, including Bublicious, including Adotus, Bloomberg Business Week, Huffington Post, There have been also a few things that I've contributed to over the past. I've been in some magazines and et cetera, but it's really just, it all comes down to the relationships that I have with these different reporters, and it just seems to come out naturally from that. But
yeah,
on top of the sort of like the social media and the press stuff, I think just the technology savvy side of myself has always been there, and just growing up in Silicon Valley, having coded a few websites in high school and in college. I didn't actually study computer science in college, but I did take some computer science classes. And I think just that picture just sort of rounds out the skill sets that you really need as an entrepreneur. You need to be good at a lot of different things, and you need to be a different person to different people.
Absolutely. So let's talk about some of the press that you've had recently. I know one of the things that I had to comment on that I loved, because this has actually happened to me, believe it or not, as well. And you mentioned it first thing in your post. It was on Huffington Post, and you may remember I commented when it was on fed onto Facebook. Was started out, you know, with Marissa, will you marry me? I believe was
yes.
First line, and you talked about these. Tell us about the article. I'm going to let you talk.
Yeah,
about
it was. I was asked to do the article as a part of a series on powerful women in love, and I was asked to contribute to that from a friend, Megan Carberry, who actually is a writer for Huffington Post as well as Causecast. I met her through some other friends who are sort of in the both social media space, tech space, in the larger political space, and so on and so forth. So Megan and I are friends, and she asked me to contribute to this because she said, "Hey, Marissa, you're a young CEO, and and it's not typical for a CEO to be a female and to be young, I guess, in Silicon Valley. So you know, we'd like to have you on here." And, I mean, my take on that was, okay, I'm going to be brutally honest, and I'm going to talk about what it's like to sort of be dating and in love and relationships as a busy tech CEO here in Silicon Valley. And so the starting line, like you said, Marissa, will you marry me? That was that's a line that's been said to me, I think, I mean, whether it was serious or not, but that's been said to me, I think, about four times in the past 3 months.
Yeah, absolutely. And I get so, even more, and I don't know if you do, of the, I tend just to friend people. You know, I don't know if they know me from the show or whatever. And so, you know, if they look harmless, you know, you friend them, right? And you find out more about them. And they might be someone you've just, you know, that is a friend of a friend and whatever, and I'm learning I have to be a little bit more cautious because I've had, like, actual virtual sexual advances, you know? It's
it's quite creepy, right?
Yeah, it can be.
Yeah.
You know, like, I've had to disable chat when I go onto Facebook because I'm doing it so much for work, you know? It's like, can't be propositioned in the middle, and my husband probably wouldn't appreciate it.
Exactly. I mean, people have, I mean, my younger sister unfortunately passed away 3 years ago, but somebody hand drew a picture of me and my sister. Somebody said, "Marissa, will you marry me?" on a Facebook message. Somebody said, "Oh, hey, I saw you at the store, but I felt too nervous to come and say hi, and I'm freaking out because he's saying, oh, you were wearing this and this and this," and I'm like, oh my God. Okay, these people are actually seeing me in real life. So it does get sort of scary, but it does make me wonder how the Hollywood A-list, not just the social media A-list of yours, but how the Hollywood A-list, like Jennifer Aniston, deals with people who recognize her all over the world. And so I think, you know, our problem is a lot less worse than hers.
Yeah, although, you know, it'd be nice to be able to, have the legion of helpers/bodyguards around you all of the time. So it's a definite, but it is a definite trade-off. I mean, it definitely shows you what the trade-off is. And, you know, you're young, attractive, and a professional, obviously, on the rise. So it makes sense in some ways, but it's kind of doesn't in others. We're in a weird confluence of things. But I wanted to talk about some of the contributions you've made to Bloomberg Business Week, because you've done some really great writing yourself. And, you know, I'm Columbia J School grad and was a journalist for most of my career before.
I was very impressed.
Yeah, well, thank you. So, you know, that is the spirit of this show. And I you know, as someone who's been an editor and a writer, you do a great job. And I was just wondering, you know, how much you're able to spend time writing and what you look at for in terms of opportunity and kind of what you're proudest of in terms of what you've written to be able, because I see it as a real way to help others as well as give insight into what it is that you're working on now.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, I try to limit my blog contributions to once every 2 to 4 months for myself personally. Just because it's, I always weigh what are the trade-offs in terms of the time I take to write a blog post, which is typically between an hour to an hour and a half, because I need to research and I need to put it all together and whatnot. What's the trade-off between the time I spend blogging and the audience and the audience response? Am I going to get the audience response I want out of a certain blog post? And typically, you know, I have a lot of need to sort of push HeroX, and also there's the other aspect of pushing Marissa Louie as a separate personal brand. And so just weighing those two, you know, I found that typically it's optimal for me to blog once every 2 to 4 months, although I've been doing it more so lately because I've been very excited about this topic of commerce in the real world. And what I've been writing about in Bloomberg Business Week more so is sort of how commerce is coming to play and how HeroX is bridging the gap between the online world and the physical, real-time, real world, where it's not just, okay, you order something from Amazon.com and they ship it from a warehouse in Akron, Ohio, and you get it in 3 to 5 days. And so what I'm looking towards now is saying, well, okay, we've got a lot of these mobile apps such as Foursquare, Gowalla, Double Dutch, which is made by my friend Lawrence Coburn, who is the CEO of Rate It All. There's also a lot of iPhone apps and et cetera. But what does that sort of pave the way towards, and what is that symbolic of in our society? It's symbolic of a lot of people engaging with each other. But the thing that's lacking from a lot of these apps, a lot of these virtual apps, is engagement with the real world and extracting real value from a place. So, for example, with Foursquare and Gowalla, you can't really, I mean, you check in a place, and yes, your friends might see it, but very often, I wonder, what do I get out of checking into a physical space such as, I don't know, RN44 or something, and I check in there, I'm looking for a bottle of wine, and then what? You know, it's sort of like, okay, I have a badge for going to, for picking up a bottle of wine, but what else do I get out of it aside from a virtual pretty sticker? It's not even a real sticker. Mm-hmm. So what I'm looking for more, and the question I've been asking a lot of people is, how do we get more out of this mobilized world? What is the next step? And so HeroX is one stab at trying to bridge the world of the bridging the physical world with the online world and leveraging the viral aspects that the web enables, leveraging the communities that the web enables, and connecting real services such as couriers who actually buy things, pick up things for you, and connecting those two. And I think that there's a fundamental shift in terms of how our society is working, and that we are very time limited. We are so limited that even, you know, when we leave our desks to go pick up lunch, we will spend, you know, maybe 20, 30 minutes picking up lunch, and then we'll come back to our desk. but it takes about 20 minutes to readjust back to the tasks that we were doing before we picked up lunch. So, I mean, just because of this crazy world, this crazy hectic world, there are certain things that I think we'll see in the next few months even develop that will sort of be potential solutions to this question of how do we bridge the gap between the worlds. There's also Chat Roulette, which I'm very excited about. I don't know if you've checked out Chat Roulette, but it allows you to pop up a video of yourself on a webcam. It lets you interface with a random person that's randomly selected. And then you can, if you want to talk to them, you stay online with them. And if not, then you press next. It's sort of like Hot or Not.
Yep. It's very, very cool and very, I think for a lot of people, probably very, very much like Foursquare in that you don't get what it's for at first, but then once you get it, you really get it because you can pitch ideas. You can, the kind of, arbitrary nature of it allows you to get all kinds of messages to all different kinds of people.
Right. It's a fun factor, and it's not just exchanging text to people. It's saying, hey, I'm here on camera. You see me as I am. I can't fake who I am. You actually see me. You actually judge me and based on how I look and based on what I'm talking about. So I think that it's sort of symbolic of our fun and fast society and just how much faster it's going, because in Chat Roulette you can flip through it so quickly, and it's sort of really neat, I think, and it's got that entertainment factor, and it's got that it's just compelling enough to keep you locked in, especially if you're bored, especially if you're hanging out with friends, you have nothing else to do, turn that on and you're bound to have a riot.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Assuming that people like the way you look. That's probably part of
exactly.
it. Part of it there. So I want to go back. Some people have been asking questions about, because we alluded to funding, but we never really asked you about it, and I don't mean to be evasive or invasive. So, answer as you can. But, how did you fund, and how are you looking to fund the scaling of HeroX?
Yeah, definitely. So the interesting thing about me as an entrepreneur is that I have self-funded every single venture I've ever done, ranging from my first startup to AdVillage to HeroX. And so we've been very scrappy and smart about the way we do things. Mm-hmm. And for HeroX, what we're looking to do is to raise $500K over the next to run us through the next 6 to 12 months, $500K, onboard a few more employees, and also use that money to stock up more on items that we know for sure people want, such as the iPhone 4, such as the iPad, and things like that, where we know that they'll be hit sellers based on our past transactions that we've had a record of over the past year. And so a lot of that will be spent on both inventory and on staff. And then the third component there is also in marketing and outreach for our customers.
And you mentioned that I'm saying already because a lot of companies wait a long time to include PR, but you're including PR already, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's never too early to do PR as long as your website can handle the traffic. I've been doing some PR. I think we haven't done even a full-fledged effort, but once we sort of turn that tap on, it's going to be a huge, huge effort, and I think it's going to be quite a big hit in the media. So we just sort of declined a lot of requests for media, and so we're sort of just monitoring that and just keeping it on the down low until we change some things operationally and internally with HeroX, and until we're ready to make the big push.
Absolutely. So one of the things that obviously we have in common and how we really got to know each other was through the social media marketing, if I can say it correctly,
yes.
Conference.
SMMSF. Yes.
Yes. So the hashtag, yes, is SMMSF. Social Media Marketing Conference 2010 in San Francisco. So for the folks that missed the show on Monday, you're one of the organizers. I'm on a panel
Yes.
And I'm really excited and honored to be on the panel. Show's almost sold out, but tell people, you know, what they can expect if they've signed up, or you know, if they'll be able to catch anything online, or I guess start from, you know, the place of you know what you're, you know, we're a few days away from the event. It's coming up on Thursday.
Yes.
And where you're at in terms of what you hope everyone gets out of the event.
Sure. Well, first of all, the website is socialmediamarketing.co.uk/San Francisco. I'm very honored to have Jennifer on the panel with us for
nice.
how to manufacture community evangelists. But the important thing about it that I want people to get out of it is it's not just a sort of a flimsy marketing event, but it really gets deep down and into the nitty-gritty of how to run social media campaigns, how to do A/B testing for social media, how to test whether or not a certain social media campaign will be successful or not in comparison to another thing that you've done. Interfacing with actual members of the press from Financial Times, from Forbes, from USA Today, Technorati, Mashable. We've got a lot of the senior reporters and CEOs of those companies coming by and speaking to the audience. And so I think it's going to be a really great opportunity. We've capped the capacity at 150 people. Like you said, we're nearly sold out. And I think it's just a really great opportunity to ask the experts, the real experts, the questions that matter the most, and to see what their takes on are from everything from building a community to getting an inside look at how tech reporters cover social media. It's going to be quite an exciting adventure, I think, in terms of just even being able to meet and greet with the speakers, just because it's a small audience and it's a good opportunity to network with the speakers as well.
Absolutely, and I think one of the things that's interesting too is that in terms of the kinds of coverage we've talked about that you've been able to garner, there are actually two different sessions that cover writing and basically, you know, either getting something written about you or digital PR. And really getting inside, you know, with you've got, you know, people, Tom Ferensky, who's been on the A-list before from Silicon Valley Watcher, who we love, and just tons of people.
Tom's a great friend, yeah.
Oh, he's such a great guy, and he'll come, you know, if you're having an event, have alcohol, he will,
I really like about Tom is just his pedigree at Financial Times. He was a newspaper reporter, and then he's been come to be heralded as the expert on knowing which Silicon Valley events are worth going to, even for the experts like myself. And so even our mutual friend Kim McNicholas, who is a reporter anchor for Forbes, looks to Tom and looks to his schedule to see which events he's going to. He always knows what's up and coming and knows the insider stuff that maybe 20 people are invited to, but which people like yourself, Jennifer, and I would be interested in.
Yeah, absolutely. He's a great one to kind of, you know, to the extent that it makes sense to sort of cyber stalk his schedule on, you know, Facebook or wherever it's safe. I don't ever encourage in-person stalking, but, you know, definitely look online and Plancast and other things allow you to do that. But he's definitely got a fantastic nose for that. I also wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, obviously the URL is .co.uk and kind of the genesis of it. We talked Monday with Marie Newlands, who was one of the or the organizer of the event that happened in London. So you want to talk about, you know, that piece of the pie as well?
Yeah, sure. So Marie Newlands is an up-and-coming blogger and also now conferencer, a person who's organizing conferences around social media topics such as email marketing, such as viral engagement, and now in San Francisco with social media marketing. He is definitely focusing on conferences as his sort of niche here. And so it spun out of the UK with Murray's idea. He tapped me to found this in San Francisco, and Herex is sponsoring it as well. But he tapped me to sort of help put together the speaker lists. So I've been able to put together almost all the speakers that we have coming on July 8th. And again, the URL is socialmediamarketing.co.uk/San Francisco. So just because it originated in the UK, that's why we have the .co.uk. And I told Murray, hey, I think it's kind of cool that we've got the .co.uk because it sort of gives more authority than something like socialmediamarketing.com, where it's just a sort of run-of-the-mill, okay, that's another social media site. But the UK perspective, I think, is very interesting for, I think, people in San Francisco to learn, because just like us, they've got affiliate marketers there. They've got their own take on things coming up and coming in the tech space. And I think it's very interesting to sort of see that perspective. I mean, they even use slightly different language when they write emails. It's quite interesting to just interact with them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm lucky, I guess, in that one of the companies that I contract with is Grayling, and Grayling is based in the UK. My husband's English, so and actually we have a Welsh friend staying for the finale of the World Cup, which unfortunately doesn't include England, or at least for me, I guess. But you know, it is different. And I, you know, what I find is when I talk to sort of the digital leaders there and the digital lead at Grayling, you know, which is a PR firm, you know, it's amazing in certain areas how much further the thought process has moved along, and then mm-hmm. other areas where we've developed thought process. I think it's very complementary, but I think we've gone down different streets a little bit, and they're much, much more, for example, likely to call this digital versus social media as just one small difference, but there's like a whole story behind that. So I think that's a really great aspect, and I think, you know, Murray's going to be there, I believe, right?
Yes, Murray will be there. Also, two other of our colleagues, Luke Brinley-Jones, will be there, as well as Abby Bond. So they are both, so all three of them are flying in from the UK for this event as well.
Their organization is called Influence People.
So back to the sort of the topic of the UK aspect, it was interesting. I had a conversation with Will I Am from the Black Eyed Peas at Cipriani's in New York back a few months ago, and we were discussing where, you know, I was asking him, hey, you know, we've got Silicon Valley there in San Francisco, and, you know, where do you think the next place is going to be for sort of a confluence of digital leaders? And so he thinks the needle is definitely moving eastward, and we're seeing a lot of I'm seeing a lot of my friends, at least, move to New York because of the traditional sort of traditional sort of Wall Street financiers who are out there. So the private equity firms and some of the VC firms out there are gaining more and more prominence, and they're starting to invest more in startups. And I think that that's interesting, where Foursquare spun out of New York, for example. And so I'm seeing people move to New York, and I'm wondering together with Will-I-Am, hey, you know, where's it going to be after that? We both think it's going to be London. We think that a lot more people in the tech space will be starting to move to London. And then that's going to, you know, maybe that will happen in 5 to 10 years. And then after that, where's it going to move? I think it's going to continue to move eastward based on this mobile movement of mobile commerce and mobile technology. I think it's going to move possibly to Seoul, Korea. That's going to be a sort of a world epicenter of a lot of movement and a lot of innovation and a lot of things going on in our space.
Yeah, and it's a fantastic place and fantastic people. So I think, you know, that it's very interesting. I totally agree. And I think one of the reasons that I love the LaWeb conference every year is you do get this confluence of all different you know, lots of different people. And I mean, you know, I was moderating events, I think, into March, and I was still talking about things that had come up during the LaWeb conference, which, if you don't know what that is, just go to laweb.net. But it's a you know, the web, that takes place in Paris, France, in December every year.
Headed by our buddy Loïc Limmer.
Yeah, Loïc.
Who is quite a personality. He's awesome. Yeah.
He's so fantastic. You know, he'll tell you why you should fire your PR company, without blinking an eye. And he is, you know, so he loves to have. He loves to give his opinion, and I fully believe they're honest, but they're often controversial. So that's fun. And his wife, Geraldine, who is kind of the unsung hero, but she is one of the conference organizers. So, you know, I think that's that and the TED events, you know, there's just a lot of places where, you know, it's great to get that information. And so I think, you know, for anybody considering coming to the conference, maybe on the fence, you know, just know it's selling out soon, so you better get your tickets.
Exactly, and Jennifer, if you can tell our listeners what the discount code is for that, if you remember, I remember.
My discount code is.
And this is for 10% off, and it's if you go to the Eventbrite page, it's 10, that's 10, SMMSF 14. Am I right?
Right.
Did I get the jackpot?
Right.
10 SMMSF 14. I remember. I have a pretty good memory. So if you enter that in into our Eventbrite code, which is linked on the event website, socialmediamarketing.co.uk/San Francisco, you can see the Eventbrite link on there, and if you enter it in as the discount code, then it's 10% off, and it's thanks to Jennifer.
Yes, yeah, so and that's on my website as well. So if you just scroll on down to our, and it includes the podcast that we did on Monday, where we really went in depth and talked about what exactly, you know, even more in depth about what we'll be talking about. We only have a few more minutes left, and I really want to. Get into a couple of different phases in terms of, you know, HeroX and you know, the kinds of, you know, business decisions that you're making, that you're doing, you know, sort of, you know, I think that, you know, one of these days you'll be writing a book probably similar to Charlene Lee and Open Leadership, you know, and being able to tell, because you've got a lot of nous when it comes to business. And I'm wondering,
yes.
You know, how you gauge success? I mean, that's one of the things that I like to ask entrepreneurs is how do you know when you're on the right track? What did you measure success with? Let's talk specifically about HeroX.
Well, I wouldn't say that I'm successful. I think I'm still aiming for that. But how do we gauge success at HeroX? It's in terms of measuring. What our audience engagement is, how much people are using the brand, how many repeat customers we have, how many orders we have, and just how much progress we're making internally in terms of our logistics so that the experience is a better, more smoother flow for our customers.
And one of the things I'm wondering about, too, in terms of something that you mentioned earlier, because I used to use Webvan back in the day, as well as Cosmo, as I mentioned. But, you know, I wonder about, you know, it sounds like you're very keen to be, you know, aware of your carbon footprint. And, you know, how, you know, somebody's asking me, you know, to ask you, so in terms of how things are delivered, and, of course, being as efficient as you can, how do you weigh the carbon footprint versus the timing of getting
Sure. Well, what we are doing, that question is actually interesting because I've worked for the Environmental Protection Agency, the U.S. EPA, for about 2 years, yeah. But that was back very early in my career, about probably 10 years ago. But what I'd say about that is we primarily use bike messengers, and so they have zero carbon footprint pretty much in terms of how much gas they're using. We've also been looking at using zip cars and city car share cars in terms of partnering with them. We've been evaluating that, so I've been talking to the heads of those companies. There are also special vehicles that are being produced that are electric bikes and electric sort of other types of vehicles that we are also looking at. So I am definitely an advocate for the environment, and I think that it's not just environmentally friendly, but also cost savings for us. So it's two things that are great, sort of rolled into one. And I think we're continuing to use that philosophy as we move forward, as just sort of baked into our DNA and how we do things.
So we'll expect to see you on some green lists.
That would be interesting.
It would be really cool because there are really no delivery services. It's just a reality that people need them. But you see cities like Paris where, you know, there's that great bike exchange, the electric bike exchange, where you can go put your coins in, get mm-hmm. a bike, and then drop it off at another like kiosk of bikes. And I've talked with.
I didn't know about that, and I just went to Paris about a month ago. I wish I had known because I would have checked it out.
they're often not far from their subway or stations or metro stations, so they're kind of near those. So if you're in a car, you kind of miss them. But if you know there's certain areas where. The commute traffic is just so insane that, the last time I stayed, I was near the Louvre. So it made a lot of sense to have them in that area, especially because it's a little bit spread out. But, that's something that, I've talked with friends about, and we're like, why hasn't this happened in San Francisco? You would think that this would be perfect because, again, you've got transit, but things are spread out, like getting from BART to Caltrain can be a pain, most locals
uh-huh.
don't take the streetcar.
Jennifer, there you go. You can take that up and start that company. There you go.
Yeah.
You can do it. We'll support you here.
Good.
You can do a deal with HeroX.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to do a deal with HeroX. I got to come up with a good idea though first. So again, you're going into beta. When do you have a timeline for when beta happens?
Yeah, I think I mentioned it earlier in the podcast, but it's going to be in about a month or two. We're sort of pivoting our business towards a slightly different niche, so you'll see some changes on the website as well as in the layout, and that's going to happen in 1 or 2 months.
Very cool. Well, we only have a few minutes left, so I have my announcements to get to and thanking the audience, so I'm going to let you go onto your busy day. Marissa Louie, the CEO of HeroX. Please check out the website. It's a great service, especially if you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, but look for it in a city near you.
Great. Thank you, Jennifer.
You're very welcome. Thanks for being on. And I want to thank our listeners for tuning in to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. If you enjoyed the show, we'd be delighted if you would be so kind to friend us or add us to your favorites here on Blog Talk Radio, or rate us if you're listening on iTunes. And be sure to tune in next week. It'll be the day after the Social Media 2010 conference in San Francisco, which I should say is at the Hotel Nikko, which is a cool place to go anyway. We'll be announcing our guest next week, and that's at 12 noon Pacific, again, a week from today. As always, you can keep up with the latest information as well as the links to things we've been talking about throughout the show at JenniferLindsaySay.com. And have a fantastic, safe holiday weekend. Join us again next week.